except to say, maybe they spooked you. Is this like a threat scenario, or...
Don't get excited. You're not in trouble.
With them, maybe.
But not with us.
Not yet. Kipling could only imagine who us meant. The realities of the situation were clear. Though he had always dealt with factotums and middlemen, white-collar criminals at best, Kipling had made his bones at the firm by exploiting previously underutilized revenue streams. Revenue streams that, as his visit from the Treasury agents only reinforced, were of an extra-legal nature. Which is to say, in plain English, that he laundered money for countries that sponsor terrorism, like Iran and Yemen, and countries that murder their own citizens, like Sudan and Serbia. And he did it from a corner office in a downtown high-rise. Because when you deal with billions of dollars, you did it in plain sight, creating shell companies and disguising wire transfer origin points 6 ways from Sunday until the money was so clean it might as well be new.
"There's no problem," Ben told the man in the turtleneck. "Just a couple of young agents getting overeager. But upstairs from them, we've got things locked down, at the level where it matters."
"No," said the man. "You've got a few problems there, too. Changes in executive policy. Some new marching orders. I'm not saying panic, but..."
"Look," said Ben, "we're good at this. The best. That's why your employers..."
A hard glare. "We don't talk about them." Ben felt something electric run down his back and pucker his asshole.
"You can trust us, I'm saying," he managed. "Me. That was always my pledge. No one's going to jail over... because of this. That's what Barney Culpepper says."
The guy looked at Ben as if to say, "Maybe I believe you, maybe I don't." Or maybe he was trying to say, "It's not up to you."
"Protect the money," he said. "That's what matters.
And don't forget who owns it. Because, okay, maybe you cleaned it so good it doesn't connect to us, but that doesn't make it yours." It took a second for Ben to translate the implication. They thought he was a thief.
"No. Of course."
"You look worried."
"Don't look like that. It's okay.
You need a hug? All I'm saying is don't forget the most important things, and that's the following. Your ass is of secondary importance. Only the money matters. If you have to go to jail, go to jail. And if you feel the urge to hang yourself, well, maybe that's not a bad idea either." He took out a pack of cigarettes, shook one between his lips. "Meanwhile," he said, "get the flan. You won't regret it." Then the man in the turtleneck walked to the waiting black sedan and got in. Kipling watched as it pulled away. They went to the vineyard on Friday. Sarah had a charity auction, something about Save the Turn. On the ferry out, she brooded about their failed dinner with the maybe in-laws. Kipling apologized. "A work thing," he told her, but she'd heard that too many times before.
"Just retire, then," she said. "I mean, if it's stressing you out this much, we have more money than we could ever use. You could sell the apartment, even, or the boat. Honestly, I could care less."
He bristled at the words, the implication that this money that he'd made, that he continued to make, was somehow worthless to her. As if the art of it, the expertise he'd accumulated, his love of the deal, of every new challenge, was valueless, a burden.
"It's not about the money," he told her. "I have responsibilities."
She didn't bother arguing further. Doesn't bother saying,
"How about your responsibilities to me, to Jenny?"
As far as Sarah was concerned, she'd married a perpetual motion machine, an engine that must keep spinning or never spin again. Ben was work, work was Ben. It was like a mathematical equation. It had taken her 15 years and 3 therapists to accept that, acceptance being the key to happiness, she believed. But sometimes it still stung.
"I don't ask for much," she said, "but the dinner with the Comstocks was important."
"I know," he said, "and I'm sorry. I'll invite the guy to the club, play 9 or 18. By the time I'm finished buttering, he'll be president of our fan club.
It's not the husband that matters. It's the wife. And I can tell she's skeptical. She thinks we're the kind of people who try to buy their way into heaven.
She said this?
No, but I can tell.
Fuck her!
She gritted her teeth. This was always his way, to dismiss people. It only made things worse, she believed, even as she was jealous of him for being so carefree.
No, she said, it matters. We have to be better.
Better what?
People.
An acerbic reply died on his tongue when he saw her face. She was serious. In her mind, they were bad people somehow, just by being rich. It went counter to everything he believed. Look at Bill Gates. The man had committed half his wealth to charitable causes in his lifetime. Billions of dollars. Didn't that make him a better person than, what, a local priest? If impact was the measure, wasn't Bill Gates a better man than Gandhi? And weren't Ben and Sarah Kipling, by donating millions to good causes each year, better people than the Comstocks, who gave, at most, 50 grand? Sarah was up early Sunday morning. She puttered in the kitchen, straightening, figuring out what they needed, then put on her walking shoes, grabbed her wicker basket, and walked across the island to the farmer's market. It was muggy out, the marine layer in the process of burning off, and the sun, magnified through airborne water molecules, made the world feel liquid somehow. She passed the leaning mailboxes at the end of their turnoff and walked along the shoulder of the main road. She liked the sound of her shoes on the sand that lined the macadam, her rhythmic soft shoe. New York was so loud with its traffic and subterranean subway clatter that you couldn't hear yourself moving in time and space, couldn't hear your breath sounds coming and going. Sometimes with the jackhammering and the explosive hiss of kneeling buses, you had to pinch yourself just to know you were still alive. But here, the steel chill of night giving way to the mug of a summer day, bubbling rainbows in the air, Sarah could feel herself breathing, her muscles moving. She could hear her own hair as it brushed against the collar of her light summer jacket. The farmer's market was busy already. You could smell the seconds fermenting in hidden baskets out of sight, bruised tomatoes and stone fruit, boxed for cosmetic reasons, even though the mottled fruit was the sweetest. Every week the vendors set up in a slightly different order, sometimes the kettle corn at one end, sometimes another. The flour vendor favored the middle, the baker the end closest to the water. Ben and Sarah had been coming here for 15 years, first as renters, and then, when rich became wealthy, as owners of a modern concrete sleeve with an ocean view. Sarah knew all the farmers by name. She had watched their children grow from toddler to teen. She walked beside weekenders and locals, not shopping as much as feeling part of the place. They were going to catch an afternoon ferry. It would be pointless to buy more than a single peach, but she couldn't not come to the farmer's market on a Sunday morning. Those weeks when it rained and the market was canceled, she felt rootless. Back in the city, she would wander the streets like a rat in a maze, looking for something, yet never knowing exactly what. She stopped and studied some watercress. The fight she and Ben had had after the dinner, his cold shoulder, the mid-meal walkout, had been short but fierce. She let him know in no uncertain terms that she wasn't going to put up with his selfishness anymore. The world did not exist to satisfy the needs of Ben Kipling. And if that's what he wanted, to surround himself with people that he could walk on as he pleased, well then, he should find another wife. Ben had been uncharacteristically apologetic, taking her hand and telling her she was right, that he was sorry and would make every effort to make sure it never happened again. It took her off guard. She was so used to fighting with the back of his head, but this time he looked her in the eye. He told her he knew he had taken her for granted, that he'd taken everything for granted. He'd been arrogant. Hubris was the word he used. But from here on out, it was a new day. He actually looked a little scared. She took the fear to be a sign that her threat had actually landed, that he believed she would leave him and didn't know what he would do without her. Later she would realize that he was already afraid, afraid that everything he had, everything he was on the verge of eclipse. And so today, having witnessed her husband's contrition, having lain with him in their marital bed, his head between her breasts, his hands upon her thighs, she felt a new chapter in her life begin, a renaissance. They had talked into the late-night hours of taking a month off and going to Europe. They would walk the streets of Umbria, hand in hand, newlyweds again. Sometime after midnight, he had opened his mahogany box and they had smoked some pot, the first she'd smoked since Jenny was born. It made them giggle like kids, sitting on the kitchen floor in front of the open refrigerator, eating strawberries straight out of the crisper. She wandered past English cucumbers and baskets of loose-leaf lettuces. The berryman had arranged his wares into a trinity, green baskets of blueberries grouped with blackberries and gum-red raspberries. She peeled back the rough husks of summer corn, her fingers hungry to feel the yellow silk below, lost in an illusion. Here on the vineyard, at the farmer's market, at this precise spot, in this moment in time, the modern world vanished, the unspoken division of our silent class wars. There was no rich or poor, no privilege. There was only food tugged from loamy earth, fruit plucked from sturdy branches, and honey stolen from the beehive bush. We are all equal in the face of nature, she thought, which was, in and of itself, an idea born of luxury. Looking up, she saw Maggie Bateman in the middle distance. The moment was this. A young couple with a baby stroller passed through her center of vision, and in their passing, Maggie was revealed in profile, caught in mid-sentence, and then, as the couple with the stroller cleared completely, the man she was speaking to was himself revealed. He was a handsome man in his 40s, dressed in jeans and a T-shirt, both paint-stained, the T-shirt covered by an old blue cardigan. The man had longish hair, swept back carelessly but creeping forward, and as Sarah watched, he reached up and swept it back again, the way a horse swats flies with its tail, distracted. The first thought that hit Sarah was simply recognition. She knew that person, Maggie. The second thought was context. That's Maggie Bateman, married to David, mother of two. The third thought was that the man she was talking to was standing a little too close, that he was leaning in and smiling, and that the look on Maggie's face was similar, that there was an intimacy between them that felt more than casual. And then Maggie turned and saw Sarah. She raised a hand and shielded her eyes from the sun like a sailor searching the horizon. "Hey there," she said. And there was something about the openness of the greeting, the fact that Maggie didn't act like a woman who'd just been caught flirting with a man who was not her husband, that made Sarah rethink her first assumption. "I thought you might be here," Maggie said. Then, "Oh, this is Scott." The man showed Sarah his palm. "Hi," said Sarah. Then to Maggie, "Yeah, you know me. If the market's up, I'll be here squeezing avocados, rain or shine." "Are you going back today?" "The 3 o'clock ferry, I think." "Oh, no, don't. We've got the plane. Come with us." "Really? Of course, that's what it's... I was just telling Scott. He's got to go into the city tonight, too."
"I was thinking of walking," said Scott.
Sarah frowned. "We're on an island." Maggie smiled. "Sarah, he's kidding." Sarah felt herself flush. "Of course." She forced a laugh. "I'm such a ditz sometimes." "So that's it," said Maggie. "You have to come, both of you, and Ben. It'll be fun. We can have a drink and, I don't know, talk about art." To Sarah, she said, "Scott's a painter."
"Failed," he clarified.
"No, now that's... Didn't you just tell me you have gallery meetings next week?"
"Which are bound to go badly."
"What do you paint?" Sarah asked.
"Catastrophe," he said.
Sarah must have looked puzzled because Maggie said, Scott paints disaster scenes from the news, train wrecks, building collapses, and things like monsoons. They really are genius.
Well, said Scott, they're morbid.
I'd like to see them sometime,
said Sarah politely, though morbid is exactly how it sounded to her.
See? Said Maggie.
She's being polite, said Scott perceptively, but I appreciate it. I live pretty simply out here.
It's clear he would say more if asked, but Sarah changed subjects. What time are you guys going back? She asked. I'll text you, said Maggie, but I think around 8. We fly to Teterboro and then into the city from there. We're usually home in bed by 10:30. Wow, said Sarah. That would be amazing. Just the thought of Sunday afternoon gridlock. Eek! I mean, it's worth it. But that would be... Ben is going to be thrilled. Good, said Maggie. I'm glad. That's what it's there for, right? If you've got a plane.
I wouldn't know, said Scott.
Don't be snarky, said Maggie, turning to him. You're coming, too. She was grinning, teasing him. And Sarah decided that this was just how Maggie was, a good sport, a people person. Scott certainly wasn't giving off a vibe that the two of them were anything other than farmers market friends.
I'll think about it, he said.
Thanks. He gave them both a smile and walked off. For a moment, it felt that all three of them would go their separate ways, but Maggie lingered a bit, and Sarah felt the obligation to keep talking if she wanted to, so the two of them leaned away and then back. How do you know him? Sarah asked. Scott? Just from around, or... He's always at Gabe's, you know, having coffee, and I used to bring the kids down all the time, just a place to go to get out of the house. Rachel liked their muffins, and we just got chatty. Is he married? No, said Maggie. I think he was engaged once. Anyway, the kids and I went out to his place once, saw his work. It really is terrific. I keep trying to get David to buy something, but he said he's in the disaster business, so he doesn't really want to come home and look at that. And to be fair, they are pretty graphic. I bet. Yeah.
They stood there for a moment, out of words, like two rocks in a stream, the movement of the crowd a constant around them.
Things are good? Said Sarah. Good, yes. You?
Sarah thought about the way Ben kissed her this morning. She smiled.
They are. Great. Well, let's catch up on the plane, huh? Amazing. Thanks again. Okay, see you tonight.
Maggie gave her a quick air kiss, and then she was gone. Sarah watched her go, then went to find some more strawberries. At the same time, Ben sat on the deck, reclaimed wood, ivied trellis, and watched the waves. Laid out on the kitchen counter were a dozen bagels with lox, heirloom tomatoes, capers, and a local artisanal cream cheese. Ben sat on a wicker chair with the Sunday Times and a cappuccino, a light wind in his face off the ocean. He had traded texts with Culpepper all weekend, using an app called Redact that blacked out messages as you read them, then erased them for good. Out on the ocean, sailboats inch across the wave caps. Culpepper wrote cryptically that he had been digging into the government's case through back channels. He used emoticons instead of key words, assuming it would make the texts harder to use as evidence were the government to somehow crack the app.
Looks like they have a key, frown face, feeding them dirt.
Ben wiped tomato runoff from his chin, finished his first bagel half. A whistleblower? Is that what Culpepper was saying? Ben remembered the man with the turtleneck outside Bali, his nose broken in a Russian prison. Did that really happen? Sarah came out onto the porch with half a grapefruit. Where he'd just gotten up, she'd already been to a spin class in town.
Ferry leaves at 3:30, Ben told her, so we should be there at 2:45.
Sarah handed him a napkin, sat.
I ran into Maggie at the farmer's market.
Bateman?
Yes. She was with some painter. I mean, not with, but they were talking.
Uh-huh, he said, preparing to tune out the rest of the conversation.
She said there's room on their plane tonight. This got his attention.
She offered?
Unless you want to take the ferry, but you know, the traffic Sunday night.
No, that sounds... Did you say yes?
I said I'd talk to you, but assume we're in.
Ben sat back. He'd text his assistant to have a car sent to Teterboro. He was taking out his phone to do it when he had another thought. David. He could talk to David. Not in detail, of course, but to the extent that he was having some troubles, one mogul to another. Was there a strategy David recommended? Should they hire a crisis manager preemptively? Start looking for a scapegoat? David also had close ties to the executive branch. If there really were new marching orders to the Justice Department, maybe David could get them some advance word. He put his half-eaten bagel down, wiped his hands on his pants, stood.
I'm going to take a walk on the beach. Sort some things out.
If you wait a minute, I'll go with you.
He started to tell her he needed the time to think, but paused. After the fiasco with Jenny's boyfriend, he needed to go the extra mile. So he nodded and went inside to get his shoes. The ride to the airport was short, the car picking them up just after 9 p.m. They rode in the air-conditioned rear, moving through dimming twilight, the sun low on the horizon, an orange yolk dipped slowly into a cool meringue. Ben reviewed what he wanted to say to David, how to sidle up on the thing. Not, there's a crisis, but have you heard anything coming out of the White House that might affect the market in general? Or no, that's too inside baseball. Maybe it was as simple as, we're hearing rumblings about some new regulations. Can you confirm or deny? He was sweating, despite the 68-degree interior. Next to Ben, Sarah was watching the sunset with a whispered smile. Ben squeezed her hand encouragingly, and she looked over and gave him a big grin. Her man. Ben smiled back. He could just about slay a gin and tonic right now. Ben was getting out of the car on the tarmac when Culpepper called. It was 9:15 and balmy, a heavy fog hanging on the edges of the runway.
It's happening, said Culpepper as Ben took his overnight bag from the driver.
What?
Indictments. A birdie just told me.
What?
When?
In the morning. The feds will come in force waving warrants. I had a shitstorm call with Leroy, but he's got to side with the president on this one. We need to send a message to Wall Street or some such shit. I've got 100 temps in there right now taking care of things.
Things?
What does the Cookie Monster do to cookies?
Ben was shaking. His creative reasoning center was closed.
Jesus, Barney, just say it!
Not on the phone. Just know that what Stalin did to the USSR is happening to our data. But you don't know anything. As far as you're concerned, it's just another Sunday night.
What should I...
Nothing. Go home, take a Xanax, sleep. In the morning, put on a comfortable suit and moisturize your wrists. They're going to arrest you at the office. You and Hoover and Tabitha, etc. We have lawyers on retainer standing by to bail you out, but they'll be dicks and hold you the maximum time allowed.
In jail?
No, at Best Buy. Yes, in jail, but don't worry. I've got a good lice guy.
He hung up. Ben stood on the tarmac, oblivious to the warm wind and Sarah's concerned stare. Everything looked different now. The creeping fog, the shadows below the plane. Ben half expected fast lines to drop from a helicopter sky, shock troops descending.
It's happening, he thought.
The absolute worst-case scenario.
I will be arrested. Indicted.
Jesus, Ben, you're like a ghost.
Behind them, the two-man ground crew finished gassing up the plane.
No, he said, trying to pull himself together. No, it's... I'm fine. Just... some bad news from the markets. Asia.
The two men pulled the hose back, away from the fuselage. They were wearing khaki coveralls and matching caps, their faces darkened by shadow. One of them took a few steps away from the gas line, pulled out a pack of cigarettes. He lit one, the flame illuminating his face with an orange flicker. Ben squinted at him.
Is that?
He thought. But the face went dark again. His fight-or-flight instinct was so strong right now, it was as if every fear he had ever had was surrounding him in the fog. His heartbeat was thunderous, and he shivered despite the heat. After a moment, he realized that Sarah was talking to him.
What?
He said.
I said, should I worry?
No, he told her. No, it's just, you know, I'm really looking forward to the trip we talked about. Italy, Croatia, I think it'll be, I don't know, maybe we should go tonight.
She took his arm.
You're so crazy, she told him, squeezing.
He nodded. The first man finished securing the fuel hose, climbed into the cab of the truck. The second man dropped his cigarette, ground it out, walked to the passenger door.
I wouldn't want to be flying in this, he said.
And there's something about the way he said it. An implication. Ben turned.
What?
He said. But the man was already closing his door. Then the truck pulled away. Was that a threat of some kind? A warning? Or was he being paranoid? Ben watched the truck roll back to the hangar until its taillights were just two red spots in the fog.
Babe?
Said Sarah. Ben exhaled loudly, trying to shake it off.
Yeah, he said.
Too big to jail. That's what Barney had said. It was just a ploy. The government was trying to make an example, but when it came down to it, the secrets he had, the implications to the financial markets, he had to believe that Barney was right, that this thing would settle quietly for a few million dollars. The truth was, he'd prepared for this day. Planned for it. He'd have been an idiot not to, and if there was one thing Ben Kipling wasn't, it was an idiot. He had insulated himself financially, hiding funds, not everything, of course, but a couple of million. There was a litigator on retainer. Yes, this was the worst-case scenario, but it was a scenario they had built a fortress to handle. Let them come, he thought, surrendering himself to fate. Then he squeezed Sarah's hand, breathing again, and walked her to the plane.
2.
Cunningham. It's never been a secret that Bill Cunningham has problems with authority. In some ways, that's his brand, the fire-breathing malcontent, and he's translated it into a $10 million a year contract with ALC. But in the same way a man's nose and ears become exaggerated as he ages, so do the psychological issues that define him. We all become caricatures of ourselves if we live long enough. And so over the last few years, as his power grew, so too did Bill's fuck you and the horse you rode in on attitude. Until now, he's been like some blood-drinking Roman Caesar who believes deep down he may be a god. Ultimately, this is why he's still on the air after all the bullshit corporate crybabying over his alleged phone hacking. Though if he's being honest, which he isn't, he'd have to admit that David's death had a lot to do with it. A grief response and power vacuum in a moment of crisis that Bill was able to exploit by delivering what he calls leadership, but was really a kind of moral bullying.
You're gonna, he said, let me get this straight. You're gonna can me in a moment of all-out war?
Bill, said Don Liebling, don't you do that.
No, I want... You need to say it on the record, so when I sue your asses for $1 billion, I can be specific on the stand while I'm jerking off into some caviar.
Don stares at him. Jesus. David's dead. His wife is dead. He gets quiet for a moment, overcome by the immensity of it. His goddamn daughter. And I can't even say it out loud.
Exactly. Said Bill. You can't, but I can. That's what I do. I say things out loud. I ask the questions no one is willing to, and millions of people watch this channel because of that. People who are going to run to CNN if they turn on our coverage of the death of our own fucking boss and see some second-string automaton with Fisher-Price snap-on hair reading his opinions off a teleprompter. David and his wife and daughter, who I held her at her fucking baptism, are lying somewhere at the bottom of the Atlantic with Ben Kipling, who I'm hearing was about to be indicted. And everybody's using the word accident like nobody on earth had reason to want these people dead. Except then, why did the man travel in a bulletproof limousine and his office windows could take a hit from a goddamn bazooka?
Don looks over at Franken, Bill's lawyer, already knowing that in the war between common sense and marketing genius, marketing is going to win out. Franken smiles.
Gotcha.
And that's how it came to pass that Bill Cunningham was back on the air Monday morning, 3 hours after the news of the crash broke. He sat before the cameras, his hair unbrushed, in shirt sleeves, his tie askew, looking for all intents and purposes like a man felled by grief. And yet when he spoke, his voice was strong.
"Let me be clear," he said. "This organization, this planet, has lost a great man, a friend and leader. I wouldn't be sitting in front of you right now."
He paused, collecting himself.
"I'd still be throwing weather in Oklahoma if David Bateman hadn't seen potential where no one else could. We built this network together. I was his best man when he married Maggie. I was, godfather to his daughter Rachel. And that is why I feel it is my responsibility to see that his murder is solved, and that the killer or killers are brought to justice."
He leaned forward and stared into the lens.
"And yes, I said murder. Because whatever else could it be? Two of the most powerful men in a city of powerful men whose plane disappears over the dark Atlantic, a plane serviced just the day before, flown by top-notch pilots who reported no mechanical issues to flight control, but somehow dropped off radar 18 minutes after takeoff. Look at my face. No one on earth can convince me there wasn't some kind of foul play involved."
The ratings that morning were the highest in the history of the network, and they continued to climb from there. As the first wreckage was found, the first bodies washed up on shore, Emma Leitner found by a dog walker on Fisher's Island on Tuesday, Sarah Kipling hauled in by lobstermen on Wednesday morning, Bill seemed to rise above himself, like a relief pitcher in the bottom innings of a too-close-to-call Game 7. That day, Bill spun the grim discovery of human remains toward further intrigue. Where was Ben Kipling? Where was David Bateman? Didn't it seem convenient that of the 11 people on the plane, passengers and crew, only 7 bodies remained missing, including those of the 2 men most likely to have been targeted by as-yet-unknown forces? If Ben Kipling was sitting with his wife, as had been reported, why was her body recovered and not his? And where was this Scott Burroughs character? Why did he still insist on hiding his face from the world? Is it possible he was involved somehow?
"Clearly he knows more than he's saying," Bill told the viewers at home.
Sources inside the investigation had been funneling ALC information since the first boots hit the ground. From this, they were able to break the seating chart before anyone else. They were also the first to break news of Kipling's imminent indictment. It was Bill who broke that the boy, JJ, had been asleep when he arrived at the airfield and was carried onto the plane by his father. His personal connection to the story, the marathon hours he spent behind the anchor desk, frequently having to pause to collect himself, made it hard for viewers to change the channel. Would he break down entirely? What would he say next? Hour after hour, Bill cast himself as a kind of martyr. Jimmy Stewart on his feet in the Senate chambers, refusing to succumb or surrender. But as the days went on, even the back-channel leaks began to seem false. Could there really be no new leads on the location of the wreckage? And now that all the other outfits had the Kipling story, the Times ran a 6,000-word piece on Sunday that showed in minute detail how his firm had laundered billions from North Korea, Iran, and Libya, Bill became less interested in digging for dirt there. He was reduced to opinion pieces, to going over old ground, pointing at timelines, yelling at maps.
And then he had an idea.
Bill meets Namor at a dive bar on Orchard Street. Black box, no sign. He chooses it because he figures none of the grungy liberal elite of the Nouveau Riche knows his face. All the bearded Sarah Lawrence graduates with their artisanal ales who think every conservative pundit is just another friend of their dad's. In preparation, Bill exchanges his trademark suspenders for a t-shirt and leather bomber jacket. He looks like a former president trying to be cool, Bill Clinton at a U2 concert. The bar, Swim, is defined by low lighting and glowing fish tanks, giving it the look of a mid-1990s sci-fi action movie. He orders a Budweiser, unironically, and finds a table behind a big saltwater tank, then watches the door for his man. Sitting behind the tank gives the illusion that he is underwater, and through the glass, the room takes on a funhouse mirror quality, like what a hipster bar would look like after the oceans rose and consumed the earth. It's just after 9 p.m., and the place is half-filled with bro clusters and hipster first dates. Bill sips the king of beers and checks out the local talent. Blonde girl, decent tits, a little chubby. Some kind of East Asian number with a nose ring. Filipino? He thinks about the last girl he fucked. A 22-year-old intern from GW he bent over his desk, coughing his orgasm into her brown hair after 6 glorious minutes of watch-the-door jackhammering. His man enters in a raincoat, an unsmoked cigarette tucked behind his ear. He looks around casually, sees Bill's comically oversized head magnified through the fish tank, and approaches. "I'm assuming you thought you were being stealthy," he says, sliding into the booth. "Choosing this dump?" "My core audience are 55-year-old white men who need 2 heaping tablespoons of fiber to take a halfway decent shit every morning. I think we're in the clear here." "Except you came by town car, which is loitering at the curb this very minute, drawing attention." "Shit," says Bill, pulling out his phone and telling his driver to circle. Bill met Namor on a junket to Germany during the second Bush's first regime. Namor was introduced to him by a local NGO as a man to know, and right off the bat, the kid was feeding him gold. So Bill cultivated him, buying him meals, theater tickets, whatever, and making himself available whenever Namor felt like talking, which was usually north of 1:30 in the morning. "What did you find out?" he asks Namor after his phone is back in his pocket. Namor looks around, gauging volume and distance. "The civilians are easy," he says. "We're already up on the flight attendant's father, the pilot's mother, and the Bateman aunt and uncle. Eleanor and, what's it, Doug?" "Right. They must be giddy," says Bill, "winning the goddamn orphan lottery. It's got to be something like $300 million the kid inherits." "But also," says Namor, "he's an orphan." "Boo-hoo. I wish I was an orphan. My mother raised me in a boarding house and used bleach for birth control." "Well, taps are up there on all 3 phones, hers, his, and home, and we're seeing all their electronic messages before they do."
"And this feed goes where?"
"I set up a dummy account. You'll get the info by coded text when we walk out tonight. I also hacked your voicemail so you can listen late at night while you're humping your pillow."
"Trust me, I get so much pussy. When I go home at night, the only thing I put my cock in is ice."
"Remind me not to order a margarita at your house." Bill finishes his beer, waves at the bartender for a second.
"And what about King Neptune?" he says. "The long-distance swimmer."
Namor sips his beer.
"Nothing."
"What do you mean, nothing? It's 2015.
"What can I say? He's a throwback. No cell phone. Doesn't text, pays all his bills by mail. Next thing you're going to tell me is he's a Trotskyite."
"Nobody's a Trotskyite anymore, not even Trotsky.
Probably because he's been dead for 50 years.
A waitress brings Bill a new beer. Namor signals he wants one too.
"At least," says Bill, "tell me where this fucking Boy Scout is, on what planet."
Namor thinks about that.
"What's got you so bent about this guy?" he asks. "What are you talking about?"
"I'm just saying, this swimmer. Everybody else thinks he's a hero. Bill makes a face like the word has made him physically sick.
That's like saying everything that's wrong with the country is what makes it great.
Yeah, but some failed drunk, hobnobbing with men of actual accomplishment, a hitchhiker on the Bootstrap Express.
I don't know what that... He's a fraud, I'm saying. A nobody. Muscling his way into the spotlight, playing the humble knight, when the actual heroes, the great men, are dead at the bottom of the deep blue bullshit. And if that's what we call a hero in 2015, then, buddy, we're fucked.
Namor picks his teeth. It's no skin off his nose either way, but there's a big ask here. A lot of law is about to be broken, so it's probably worth being sure.
He saved the kid, he says.
So what? They train dogs to wear whiskey barrels and find warm bodies in an avalanche, but you don't see me teaching my kids to grow up to be Malamutes.
Namor thinks about that.
Well, he didn't go home. Bill stares at him. Namor smiles without teeth.
I'm sifting through some chatter. Maybe he'll turn up.
But you don't know, is what you're saying.
Yes. For once, I don't know.
Bill pumps his leg, suddenly uninterested in his second beer.
I mean, what are we talking about here? A drunken degenerate? A black ops sleeper agent? Some kind of Romeo?
Or maybe just a guy who got on the wrong plane and saved a kid?
Bill makes a face. That's the hero story. Everybody's got the fucking hero story. It's human interest bullshit. You can't tell me that this dried-up has-been gets a seat on that plane just because he's a good guy. I couldn't even get a ride on the plane 3 weeks ago. Had to take the goddamn ferry.
I mean, you're definitely not a good guy.
Fuck you. I'm a great American. How is that not more important than what? Being nice?
The waitress brings Namor's second beer. He sips it. Here's the thing, he says. Nobody stays buried forever. Sooner or later, this guy goes to the deli to buy a bagel and somebody gets a cell phone photo. Or he calls someone we've already tapped. Like Franklin at NTSB. I told you, that one's tricky.
Fuck you. You said anybody. You said pick a name from the phone book.
Look, I can get his personal line, but not the sat phone.
What about email?
In time, maybe, but we gotta be careful. They monitor everything now since the Patriot Act.
Which you called amateur hour. Get some sack already.
Namor sighs. He has his eye on the blonde who's texting someone while her date is in the can. Once he has her name, he can fish up naked selfies in less than 15 minutes.
My memory is you said we had to cool it for a while, he says.
Wasn't that the phone call? Burn everything, wait for my signal.
Bill waves him off. That was before ISIS killed my friend.
Or whoever.
Bill stands, zips his bomber. Look, he says, it's a simple equation. Secrets plus technology equals no more secrets. What this thing needs is a brain trust, someone at 20,000 feet who's got access to all the intel. Governmental, personal, fucking forensic weather data, and he, this elevated godhead, uses that information to paint the real picture, uncover who's lying and who's telling the truth.
And that someone is you?
Fucking A right, says Bill, and walks out to his town car.
Funhouse. Scott sits alone that night and watches himself on television. It is less an act of narcissism and more a symptom of vertigo. To see his face on screen, features reversed, to have childhood photos, how did they get them, unearthed and displayed in a public forum, between commercials for adult diapers and minivans, to be told the story of his own life as if in a game of telephone. A story that resembles his own, but isn't. Born in the wrong hospital, attended a different elementary school, studied painting in Cleveland instead of Chicago. Like looking down and seeing someone else's shadow follow you on the street. He has a hard enough time these days knowing who he is without this sentient doppelganger out there. This third-person him, now a subject of rumor and speculation. What was he doing on that plane? Last week, He was an ordinary man, anonymous. Today, he is a character in a detective story. The last man to see the victims alive, or savior of the child. Each day he plays his role scene by scene, sitting on sofas and hard-backed chairs, answering questions from the FBI and NTSB, going over and over the details, what he remembers, what he doesn't. And then seeing the headlines in the paper, hearing disembodied voices from the radio. A hero. They are calling him a hero. It is not a word he can handle right now, being so far outside his own sense of himself, the narrative he has created that allows him to function. A broken man with modest ambitions, a former blackout drunk who lives moment to moment now, hand to mouth. And so he keeps his head down, dodging the cameras. Occasionally he is recognized on the subway or walking down the street. To these people, he is something more than a celebrity.
Yo, you saved that kid! I heard you fought a shark, bro! Did you fight a shark?
He is treated not like royalty, as if his fame is based on something rare, but more like a guy from the neighborhood who got lucky. Because what did he do, really, except swim? He is one of them, a nobody who did good. And so when he is recognized, people approach, smiling. They want to shake his hand, take a picture. He survived a plane crash and saved a kid. There is juju to touching him, the same boost you get from a lucky penny or a rabbit's foot. By doing the impossible, he, like Jack, proved that impossible is possible. Who wouldn't want to rub up on that? Scott smiles and tries to be friendly. These conversations are different from what he assumes it will feel like to talk to the press, their contact on a human level. And though he feels self-conscious, he makes sure he is never rude. He understands that they want him to be special. It's important to people that he be special because we need special things in our lives. We want to believe that magic is still possible. So Scott shakes hands and accepts the hugs of random women. He asks that they not take his picture, and most respect that. "Let's keep this private," he says. "It means more when it's just you and me." People like this idea, that in a time of true mass media, they could have a unique experience. But not everyone. Some take his picture brazenly as if it is their right, and others get upset when he refuses to pose for a photo with them. An older woman calls him an asshole outside Washington Square Park, and he nods and tells her she's right. He is an asshole, and he hopes she has a great day.
"Fuck you," she tells him.
Once anointed a hero by your fellow man, you lose the right to privacy. You become an object, stripped of some unquantifiable humanity, as if you have won a cosmic lottery and woke one day to find yourself a minor deity, the patron saint of good luck. It stops mattering what you wanted for yourself. All that matters is the role you played in the lives of others. You are a rare butterfly held roughly at a right angle to the sun. On the third day, he stops going outside. He is living in Layla's third-floor guest apartment. It is a space of pure white. White walls, white floor, white ceiling, white furniture. As if he has died and moved on to some kind of heavenly limbo. Time, once mired in hard-fought routine, becomes fungible. To wake in a strange bed. To make coffee with unfamiliar beans. To lift rich bath towels from self-closing cupboards and feel their hotel texture against your skin. In the living room there is a bar filled with Scottish malts and clear Russian courage. A cherrywood mid-century case with an elaborate folding lid. Scott stared at it for a long time that first night, the way a man in a certain mental state regards a gun cabinet. So many ways to die. Then he covered the bar with a blanket, moved a chair in front of it, never to look at it again. Somewhere, the Kipling wife and that beautiful flight attendant are lying face up on a steel slab. Sarah, that was her name, and the model in the short skirt was Emma Leitner. Several times a day he reviews the names like a Zen koan. David Bateman, Maggie Bateman, Rachel Bateman. He thought he had come to terms with this thing, its full import. But there was something about the news that bodies had been found that threw him off balance. They're dead. All of them. He knows they're dead. He was there, in the ocean. He dove beneath the wave. There could be no survivors, but hearing the news, seeing the footage, first bodies recovered from Bateman crash, made the whole thing real. The way your legs go out from under you only after a crisis is over. The mother is still out there, the father and sister. So are the pilots, Charlie Bush and James Melody. So is Kipling, the traitor, and the Bateman's security man, buried somewhere deep beneath the waves, swaying in permanent black. He should go home, he knows, back to the island, but he can't. For some reason, he finds himself unable to face the life he once lived, once, in this case, being 9 days ago, as if linear time means anything to a man who survived what he's survived. There is before, and there is after. Unable to approach the little white gate on a quiet, sandy road, to step over the old slip-on shoes left absently by the door, one behind the other, the toe of the back shoe resting on the heel of the front where he stepped out of it. He feels unable to return to the milk in the fridge gone sour, and his dog's sad eyes. That is his home. The man on TV who wears Scott's shirts and squints into the lens of old photographs. Are my own teeth that crooked? Unable to face the gauntlet of cameras, the endless barrage of questions. Talking to people on the subway is one thing, but addressing the masses, that's something he can't handle. A statement becomes a pronouncement when delivered to the crowd. Random observations become part of the public record, to be replayed for all eternity, auto-tuned and memeified. Whatever the reason, he feels unable to retrace his steps, to withdraw to the place he lived before. And so he sits on his borrowed sofa of the now, and stares out at the treetops and brownstones of Bank Street. Where is the boy at this moment? On a farm somewhere in upstate New York? At a breakfast table surrounded by spiky green strawberry tops and calcifying oatmeal splotches? Every night before bed, Scott has the same thought. In sleep, he will dream of the boy lost in an endless black ocean, dream of his Dopplered cries, nowhere and everywhere at once, as Scott splashes around, half-drowning, searching, but never finding. But the dream does not come. Instead, there is only the deep vacuum of sleep. It occurs to him now, sipping cold coffee, that maybe these are the boy's dreams. A projection of his anxiety floating on the jet stream like a dog whistle only Scott can hear. Is the bond between them real or implied? A product of guilt? An idea he has contracted like a virus? To save this child, to have him cling to you for 8 exhausting hours, to carry him in your arms to the hospital, did that create new pathways in the brain? Isn't the life saved enough? He is home now. This child the world knows as JJ, but whom Scott will always think of simply as the boy. Safe and cared for by a new family, by the aunt and her, well, let's be honest, shifty husband. An instant millionaire hundreds of times over who will never want for anything, and him not even 5. Scott saved his life, gave him a future, the chance of happiness. Isn't that enough? He dials information and asks for the aunt's number in upstate New York. It is 9 p.m. He has sat alone in the apartment for 2 days straight. The operator connects him, and as he listens to the phone ring, he wonders what he is doing. On the 6th ring, she answers. Eleanor. He pictures her face, the rosy cheeks and sad eyes. Hello? She sounds wary, as if only bad news comes after dark. Hey, it's Scott. But she's already talking. We already made a statement. Can you please respect our privacy? No, it's Scott, the painter, from the hospital. Her voice softens. Oh, sorry.
They won't leave us alone, and he's just a boy, you know? And his mom and dad are...
I know. Why do you think I'm hiding out? A silence as she switches from the call she thought it was to the reality. A human moment with her nephew's savior.
I wish we could, she says. I mean, it's hard enough going through this all in private without...
I'm sure. Is he...
A pause. Scott feels he can hear her thinking. How much should she trust him? How much can she say?
JJ? He's, you know, he's not really talking. We took him to a psychiatrist. I mean, I did. And he said, just give him time. So I'm not pressing.
That sounds... I can't imagine what it's like.
He doesn't cry. Not that he... I mean, he's 4, so how much can he really understand? But still, I thought he'd cry.
Scott thinks about this. What's there to say? He's just processing, I guess. Something that traumatic? I mean, for kids, whatever they go through is normal, right? I mean, in their heads. They are learning what the world is, so that's what he thinks now. Planes crash and people die and you end up in the drink. Which, maybe he's having second thoughts about the whole thing, if that's what life on this earth is all...
I know, she says.
And they sit for a minute in a silence that is neither awkward nor uncomfortable. Just the sound of two people thinking.
Doug doesn't talk much either. Except about the money. I caught him the other day downloading spreadsheet software, but emotionally, I think he's freaked out by the whole thing.
Still?
Yeah, he's, you know, he's not good with people. He had a hard childhood, too.
You mean 25 years ago?
He can hear her smile over the phone.
Be nice.
Scott likes the sound of her voice, the pace of it. There is an implication of intimacy to it, as if they have known each other a long, long time.
Not that I'm one to talk, he tells her, given my track record with women.
That is bait I will not take, she says.
They talk for a while about the daily routine. She gets up with the boy while Doug sleeps. He goes to bed late, it seems. JJ likes toast for breakfast and can eat a whole container of blueberries in one sitting. They do art projects until nap time, and in the afternoons he likes to look for bugs in the yard. On trash days they sit on the porch and wave at the haulers.
A normal kid, basically. She says.
Do you think he really understands what happened?
A long pause. Then she says,
Do you?
On Wednesday, the funerals begin. Sarah Kipling is first. Her remains buried at Mount Zion Cemetery in Queens, a graveyard in the shadow of looming pre-war smokestacks, as if there is a factory next door manufacturing bodies. Police hold the news trucks to a cordoned area on the south side of the wall. It's a cloudy day. The air stilted, tropical. Thunderstorms are forecast for the afternoon, and already you can feel the unsettled electricity in the atmosphere. The line of black cars stretches all the way to the BQE, family, friends, political figures. There will be 8 more before this is through, assuming all the bodies are recovered. Overhead, helicopters circle. Scott arrives in a yellow cab. He's wearing a black suit found in Layla's guest closet. It's a size too big, long in the sleeves. In a dresser drawer, he found, conversely, a small white shirt, too tight in the neck that leaves a noticeable gap under his necktie. He's shaved badly, cutting himself in 2 places. The sight of his blood in the bathroom mirror and the sharp slice of pain startled him back to a kind of reality. He can still taste salt water in the back of his throat, if he's being honest, even in sleep. Why is he alive and they dead? Scott tells the driver to leave it running and steps out into the mug. For a moment he wonders if the boy will be here. He forgot to ask, but then he thinks, who would bring a toddler to a stranger's funeral? The truth is, he doesn't know why he came here. He is neither family nor friend. Scott can feel the eyes on him as he walks up. There are 24 guests in black ringing the grave. He sees them see him. He is like lightning that has struck twice in the same place, an anomaly. He lowers his eyes.